This is Dr. Charles Parker, and you are listening to Core Brain Journal. It's the place where I connect both fresh discoveries and interesting different perspectives from advanced mind science with the realities of real people and everyday life down on Main Street.
Well, welcome, folks. This is Dr. Charles Parker one more time back at corebrainjournal.com, and we're really interested to have Kevin Hall here. This is going to be a very, very interesting conversation. And if you're driving the car, you want to fasten your seatbelts for this one, because Kevin has a story that is exceedingly memorable and remarkably constructive. It brings together sailing and emotional health, bipolar illness. Kevin's got a story that will keep you on the road if you hang onto the wheel. It's a very, very interesting story. So let me give you a brief introduction, and we'll go from there. Kevin, welcome aboard. Glad to have you with us.
Thank you so much. It's really an honor to be here. A little bit intimidating, but I'm going to get over that as time goes on and get used to all this. This is really exciting for me.
Well, Kevin, you're intimidating to me, buddy, because you're sailing in places that I would love to sail with people I would like to sail with. So I'm going to do an intro. So Kevin is an Ivy League graduate of Brown University, where he earned a bachelor's degree in mathematics and, get this, French literature. When you read his book, it's a very interesting, wide variety of things that he's interested in. Despite being diagnosed with bipolar in 1989, he went on to become a world champion Olympic sailor, as well as a racing navigator for the Emirates team in New Zealand in 2007, America's Cup match. I mean, it doesn't get much better than that. I mean, that would be so interesting. He is, in addition, on a personal note, a two-time testicular cancer survivor. He spent 25 years as a racing navigator. He's a speed testing manager. I'd love to know what that is. I'll ask you later. And a sailing performance and racing instruments expert. So he's a mathematician with a sailing expertise. So the bottom line on Kevin is he's written a book. He's the author of a book called Black Sails and White Rabbit, which I've had the privilege of just getting into. It came to my desk a little late, and we wanted to jump on this conversation. So, Kevin, tell us a little bit about where you are personally right now, and then we'll get more into where you're going to go.
Well, I'm personally sitting in one of my son's rooms. He's 9 years old, but I wanted to try to have the best sound possible. I'm in a big transition in my life right now. From professional athlete and somebody with the sponsored jacket and a clear role and an identity and mask to wear every day, I don't have any of those things anymore. I'm now mostly a father and husband and a lunch maker and occasionally forget soccer practice guy. And I'm trying to learn to do some things that actually are much harder than they look. Along with that, I've always wanted to write. My very first class at college was a creative writing course at 8 a.m. I don't know why I took a course at 8 a.m., but I did. And I've had the opportunity to step back from my professional career and start writing. And that's what Black Sails, White Rabbits represents.
Well, I love that book. I'm telling you, I don't know where it is. I didn't read any reviews or anything. Of course, you got some reviews on the book, of course, but I'm telling you, anyone out there that's listening to this will love this book. If you've had any kind of interest in your evolution as a human being, I mean, it's actually kind of a poet. There's poetry in it. It has kind of a Hemingway quality to it in terms of the way the writing is. I mean, he takes you right there in the dirt, and you can see it happening, and you're in his head. And then you have the appreciation of his bipolar illness, which we'll talk about in a moment, and his racing experience. I mean, it's so interesting and so well written. I just really appreciate having a chance to read it and get into it.
Well, thanks. It's been a good journey so far. It was people ask if it was healing or cathartic to write, and in many ways it was devastating. I had to go back through some of the experiences, but coming out the other side, it does give me perspective that I wouldn't have had without trying to tell my own story again.
Well, it's tough. I mean, you know, you've had a difficult time of it. So Let's talk a little bit about the book. And from this perspective, and Kevin, you and I, before we started talking, try to put a little bit of structure on this because there's so many interesting things here to talk about. But let's talk about that transformational, difficult time at Brown when you started this very difficult inward journey with self-examination and really had some painful moments.
It starts with a very wonderful and privileged childhood with loving parents, and I got passionate about sailing and had the support to do a lot of sailing from a very young age, and I won my first world championship when I was 16 years old. And in a funny way, that was sort of a setup for everything that came after that, because I saw that as me. That was my identity. I'm a world champion. I'm a sailor. I'm going to go win the America's Cup next, and then a gold medal, and on and on, and that's who I am. And my studies kind of fit in there a bit. I really like my studies, my math and the French literature. But junior year of college, I went from being a world champion and the best in the world to a guy who really didn't understand what was going on in topology and differential geometry. And that threw me for a real loop. It freaked me out to not be the best in the world anymore. And the way I seem to have addressed it is to make up a story in my head where I still was.
Yeah, well, so you had a shock there, but I want to make sure that you and I, while we're just talking personally, yes, everybody's listening to us, but the thing that hit me was the context of that shock and that deterioration where you had an internal snap there, and that was in the context of having something infectious happen. I can't remember, but you did have a fever and you were sick for maybe, was it a week or two, something like that? Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, my body broke out in a rash and I had a really high fever. I had herpes zoster, or shingles, I guess it was also called, and really bad fever. And so I missed a week of school just around the time of midterms. And when I got out of the infirmary, I didn't do healthy things with my body to try to catch up in school. I drank a lot of coffee and I thought I was studying, but what I was really doing is losing my grip on reality. And all this stress of being pretty sure I was going to fail, and all the coffee and all the stimulation of trying to learn so much at once just really threw my, not just my body, but then my head for a loop.
You know, it's terrible. And, it's for readers who are interested in this, I mean, it right at that moment when you open the book, he takes you right down into his head. I mean, I think I'm hesitating right now because I read it quickly and I was so intrigued by all the other parts of the book. I was trying to run through it and quickly put it together, which obviously is not a good idea. But the whole business of, was that in New York? Oh, that was in Boston where you were, and it was a kind of a homeless shelter, it sounded like. Tell
That's
us a little
exactly
bit about
what
that. Is. What happened
well,
there?
Yeah, so at some point after the fever and when I got out, I started to think that the whole world was watching me on TV, that there were cameras everywhere and that there was a director, and that I was basically, the voices in my head, if you will, were telling me to go here and go there and do this and do that. I made up messages with codes and taxicab doors and who knows what else. I was supposed to meet my girlfriend and I didn't turn up at the other end of the bus. And I wandered around Boston all day just kind of playing funny little mind games, but eventually found myself most at home in the homeless shelter. So I found the homeless shelter and I sat down and had soup with people who were a lot less fortunate than I was, and kind of started to really, I guess antics is the word. I just put on a play and a show, and then I got very agitated and ran out of there. And this is now some time later, 12 hours or something, I eventually got arrested for very strange behavior in a park, kind of accosting a woman and scaring her about, I called her Ophelia, and that she was supposed to recognize me, and she didn't recognize me, but I scared her. I'm not a small guy. And so she would have found some police, and it would have been clear something wasn't quite right with me, and they came and got me and eventually got me to the hospital.
Horrible experience, you know. And to think of what you've done from that moment forward with yourself is remarkably energizing and optimistic, because you really have taken the difficult experience you had and you've turned it around piece by piece. And that's really what the book is about, how you've put it together, how you continue to put it together. So when that happened, we won't go into all the details because it's totally reasonable to encourage people to read it, because it's one of these things where if you've had any work with anybody in mental health, this is a book for you. It's a fantastic book. But the key question here, I think, for somebody listening, we only have a short period of time, is how you, if you could summarize it a little bit, what would be the measures, the activities that you began to undertake to turn yourself around? I mean, you did get some medication. Let's talk a little bit about your medical care.
Yeah. I started on, after that first acute manic episode and hospitalization, I started on lithium, and Haldol even, so the delusions went away pretty quickly. But it also shut my imagination right down. Things got pretty gray. So to counter that, we went on to some antidepressants, and that kind of all worked for a while, and I was able to maintain either a facade or actually a real normal life in college and everything. And then senior year of college, halfway through, I got testicular cancer. My testicle hemorrhaged, and it was out from surgery a couple days later. And again, I was on the one hand unlucky, but on the other hand, very, very lucky to be able to be treated with surgery. Mm. After the testicular cancer, I had this question, which kind of is still in my mind, which is if this weird stuff is going to keep happening to me, shouldn't I at least feel as authentic and as good as I possibly can in the meantime? And that's where it gets really tricky with the psychiatric meds, is they take away there's this veneer over everything with the psych meds, just a little one, but it's there, and you know it's not quite you that's out in the world. It's a construction that you're trying to make into you, mm-hmm. which is backwards, really. Mm-hmm. What one wants to do is live in the world as him or herself, to be really authentic and at home in one's own skin. And with psych meds, it's just not quite how it is. You learn to become the person who feels good on those psych meds. And that's a good skill to have. It's a really good skill to have, but it's tricky.
And in the end, you feel disingenuous no matter how you slice it, because you're a smart guy and you're watching yourself. And that would encourage the whole, was it called the Truman Syndrome? I told you previously, is that what it's called? The Truman what? Truman Delusion?
Truman Show Delusion. So I reached out to after some media around it, I reached out to Dr. Joel Gold in New York, because he was describing some of his psychiatric patients who were telling him a story, which was exactly what I had lived in 1989. And that was this idea that the whole world is watching me, I'm being filmed on TV, and everybody wants to see what I'm doing day in, day out. Now, in around 1999, I think it was, a movie came out called The Truman Show, and Jim Carrey plays an amazing character who literally lives inside a huge bubble in Burbank, and he really is watched on TV by the whole world day in, day out, and he doesn't know it. Mm. And Dr. Gold called it Truman Show Delusion, and I reached out to him because what he was describing and what I had already lived a few times were identical. And that was staggering to me, that you could be same in your insanity as somebody else.
Well, you know, the thing, Kev, putting my psychiatric hat on, you'll have to forgive me, but you know, you're really a bright guy and you're a very deep person. You're very self-reflective anyway. It was kind of the equipment you brought into Brown in the first place. You may have been a good sailor and you may have had a number of accomplishments, but you're a deep guy. You were thinking deeply about the world all along. And then what happens is you were trying to identify who you were, you know, and that's what happened. You still weren't sure about who you were. This is being almost on the level of a platitude, and forgive me, but that's kind of what was going on, wasn't it?
That's exactly what was going on. And I think you're becoming sure of who you are and comfortable in the world when platitudes and cliches don't make you uncomfortable.
Thank you.
Is that a sentence?
Yeah, it works.
I didn't know who I was, and if you wear a mask and never take it off, you can get away with it. But part of me just, there was this splinter in my mind that I wasn't who I was. I was playing a role that to meet expectations, some of them my own, some of them a construction around parents and accomplishment, some of them what I heard in the media about how it was important to win the race and become famous, and I just wasn't quite me yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that would be frustrating. If you think about it, taking it away from you and depersonalizing it a little bit, but you think of a number of people, whoever it be. I mentioned Hemingway earlier, but Hemingway was a guy who was his whole life trying to figure out who he was, in my opinion. He was searching for things and then writing about it and trying to find himself through his work and through his artistry, you know. And his work was, you know, very similar to yours in the sense of he was a poet. He was writing images that were that had their own quality right within themselves on that page. And you do that. I'm going to give you credit on that.
Well, I'm happy to be put in the same sentence as Hemingway. That's pretty thrilling. I went and saw the exhibit on him at the J.P. Morgan a few months ago, and there was a handwritten letter to his parents, to his father, up there on the wall behind the glass, really, but you could read it. And he said, well, I'm sending you back my books I guess I won't send you any more books because you've sent the ones I sent you back. So this is him writing to his parents. And if he's trying to find himself, but his own parents are sending his books back because they don't want to read it, I mean, I don't know how you ever find yourself after that.
Oh, my God.
And that was when he was maybe, I'm making it up a little, but around 26 years old, I think. Mm-hmm. And that blew me away. I basically cried. I cried.
Yeah. That is a deep moment, no question about it. Well, the good news is, taking it to another level, you had these difficulties. You then had an additional testicular cancer. And how did that transform you? What happened with that?
Well, I was sort of raised not a practicing atheist, but there wasn't a lot of spirituality and religion in the house. We were all about learning and getting a buy in a society that believes in those things, and some of that is wonderful. I love knowledge and where it can lead you. But So I got testicular cancer for a second time, and to the extent I did or didn't believe in God, I was pretty sure after that he had it in for me. It just really didn't seem fair or right, or I just couldn't believe it. Mm-hmm. It really seemed wrong. So at that point, I hated God. I could say it that way. Is it succinct anyway?
Mm-hmm.
And the delusion was a place to make everything okay. I guess in a way I was blessed with this huge imagination that was able to imagine myself so important that I had to fight through my second cancer so that people could keep watching me on TV.
Mm. You know, I'm thinking of a couple of things. We haven't talked about the David Brooks book that you would love. It. I don't know if you've read it, The Road to Character.
I haven't.
It's a book for you. You will love it. Because part of what was going on, again, I don't know you from Adam. I'm just talking with you. It sounds like this because I feel like I know you a little bit from reading your book. And so there's a certain intimacy that comes from reading the book. So you'll forgive me for taking these big leaps. But one of the things, it struck me, taking it away from you and just telling you about myself. He has a line in there, which I don't recall exactly, but it had something to do with, you know, what are you doing with your life? Are you chasing a CV, a curriculum vitae? Are you looking to find a place, documentation of who you are on a CV? Are you going to leave a legacy? What are you going to leave as a legacy for what you've done in the world? I mean, are you chasing some recognition, or are you chasing a larger item of contribution to humankind? And you will love the book because it's exactly what we're talking about.
I look forward to it very much. I know that that was one of the things that deeply troubled, if that's the right word, Beethoven, as he was very concerned about his legacy. And I think deep down he knew he was special, and he was. And he's left the world with some marvelous, 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 amazing, indescribable music.
Well, you're doing that now. So the next thing is where you went after you started pulling yourself together. The way you write about your family is just wonderfully warm and delightful to listen to because, you know, for a guy out there, you're a good role model for guys who are doing the guy thing, who have, I've met a lot of guys who are extremely cool, macho hot dog guys who have, on the outside, they look that way, but inside are really warm, delightful human beings who have a great sensitivity about the people around them. And you certainly have that. And the whole business of how you developed that family, could you tell us a little bit about that?
I'd love to. So I married my first wife because my second wife dumped me, is how I like to say it. And Amanda and I, Amanda's my wife now, dated in college, and then she gave me the boot for a little while, so I got married right away to spite her. Our very first date together with Amanda, I took her back to my place, and we listened to Peter and the Wolf. And I think it was pretty important to me at the time that she know that I liked fairy tales. And mm-hmm. I wanted to make sure that she knew she might not be getting a guy's guy if she hung around with me. Well, that mm-hmm. and I was already missing a testicle, so so there's that.
Yeah.
But my bipolar illness challenges have been really challenging for my family, and I'm not actually on great terms with my dad at the moment around it, which is sad, but I'm sure time will heal that. But my mom and my sister and especially Amanda they've just always been there, and that saved my life. Their belief in me in times when I couldn't carry it for myself saved my life. Love is what I think a lot of people call it.
Well, and Amanda seems to understand you so well, and she has her own remarkable depth as a human being. I mean, the woman side of your masculine story is very interesting because she's just a great gal. I mean, everywhere you slice it, she sounds, I don't know if she helped you with your writing at all. My sense of it was there were a couple of comments that she made, and she certainly has the ability to be constructively critical in the writing, as well as being just there in so many other ways.
Amanda is tremendous, and it's not a stretch to say I owe my life to her. What's kind of interesting in the family and relationship context is my dad is a now retired emergency room physician, and my mom's a pediatrician, and Amanda's two specialties that she looked at during med school were, ER and pediatrics. And so Amanda's an ER physician, and she's great at it. And she's one of those doctors with the bedside manner to match her expertise. And she brings that home a bit with me, too. She sees me sometimes as somebody who needs to be helped and healed, and she's right.
Well, I mean, that may be one part of it. Pardon me for disagreeing with you a little bit, okay? That's a part of it. But she sees this thing that you have. She's a partner with you. That's what I'm disagreeing with you a little bit because you have so many interesting qualities. Who wouldn't want to hang out with you? I mean, give me a break. I mean, the only person that wouldn't want to hang out with you is a person who doesn't get it. You know,
she talks about having fallen in love with a poet, and a lot of my journey over the last 25 years is to let that poet live in this world, and that's tricky.
Yeah, it is. It is. And you do a good job. I mean, writing is something any way you can get that down. It's so constructive and so realistic and so evocative. I mean, just really, pardon me for being so emphatic, but I mean, I think it's one of these things people really need to read your doggone book, no question about it. So then where can we take this together, Kev? What would be your most important constructive piece of advice for a person who is suffered bipolar illness and been down the trip with you, what would you say would be your overview of a person's relationship with, like, if you forgive the expression, the medical establishment?
Well, in the book, I talk a little bit about my infatuation with synchronicities and coincidences. And today, here in New Zealand, it's March 30th. It happens to be World Bipolar Day. I think because Van Gogh maybe was born on March 30th. So it's in the world consciousness today that mental health is challenging. It's very challenging. And I think where family and friends and colleagues maybe aren't able to see all the way in is this idea that those of us who suffer from mental health aren't trying our darndest. I mean, at least for me, I remember having kind of a big argument with my sister. She said, I know you really want to be sort of absolved of all this behavior and have it taken off your shoulders. And I jumped down her throat and I said, no, I want nothing more than to be able to be responsible for myself in this world. That's what I want. It's just seems to be that with the hand I'm dealt, it's quite hard.
I'm going to rephrase what you said a little bit. What you're saying is I'm actively taking care of myself, friends. And what the admonition or whatever the remark was a remark about passivity. If somebody could lift this for you, and what you were saying is, no, I'm doing my damnedest to take care of myself, and that's really what the deal is.
Yeah, this being here before you, whether he's just had a whole bottle of whiskey or whether he's just been a little bit short and violent, or whether he's just gone and made up a story about himself and that he's saving the world because he's on TV, this being in front of you is trying his best to live in this world. But what the message you're giving back to him, what you're reflecting, is that he needs to try harder. He needs to do better. And that's where I think, at least for me, when my suicidal ideation times came in, it was everybody making me feel like I had to try harder and do better, and me feeling like I was already doing my best. And that's you could call it a paradox if you don't introduce the time element, where the only way out is to jump.
Yeah.
If you don't allow for love and healing and seeing into the future, the only way out of the paradox that you're doing your best and yet you're being told you have to do better is to jump.
Wow. Yes, indeed. And so what you did, you pulled from down in your marrow, in your bones, started when you were a young guy sailing, you have a determination to make it. And you then turned it around. Did you then begin sailing in that? How did the sailing, going back to sailing and becoming an ocean navigator, how did all that play into your recovery?
The sailing is what sidelined my self-evolution into being a poet, and I would never trade it away for anything because it's brought me to where I am today. But the determination to win first a world championship and then hopefully one day a gold medal and then the America's Cup, that determination was raw, and it was there in fourth grade. And I remember the scene like it was yesterday, where, you know, somebody was teasing me because I couldn't throw or catch a ball very well. I was always last one picked. I sucked. And they were teasing me, and I said, well, that's fine because I'm going to the Olympics and you sure as heck never are. And in fourth grade, I just knew. I knew I was going to do whatever it took to get there, and that was who I was. And that determination served me well in some other challenges.
That is so interesting. What would you say back to the other thing we started talking about? There's so many interesting avenues to talk about. But in terms of being helpful to our audience group who may be identifying with some of the things that are troubling you in terms of your own evolution, what would you say would be your take on your relationship? You've had probably more than one doctor, I would assume, but what's your interface with medical care, and what's your thought about medical care, and what do we need to do about it that could improve it?
Yeah, you asked that once and I completely lost it.
No, I lost it myself because I was interested in what you were saying. Okay. And
that it's a partnership and it's a long-term collaboration, and that it's the person with mental illness challenges needs to feel like he or she is part of a village, and it really does take a village. And you can want him to pull himself up by his bootstraps and sort his shit out, but excuse my French, it might not happen. It does take a village, and it takes people around the sufferer having the patience and the trust and the hope that with time the healing will happen. And those people are the doctor and the parents and the sisters and brothers and the partners and the colleagues, and it's about patience and love and time. And it's very hard when you're in the middle of these challenges to feel like you have any time. You feel like time's just kind of running out, and if you don't sort it out immediately, it's kind of not worth turning up to the game.
That is such an important point, because, you know, it's like we've known each other before. Talk about these magical moments in your book. But I mean, I feel like when I'm reading, it's like, oh my gosh, this guy, you know, somehow, because this is what I deal with every day, is if I can get a person to just put some time in, and if I actually have the proper attitude with that person, that they are going to instruct me in terms of what I need to do, then we're in good shape. If I go at it like I'm going to tell you what to do because you're a sick bipolar individual, it's going to all be for naught. And the whole thing is going to slam them down into some kind of negative place. And then they're going to be upset because they're going to have a sense of futility that they can't be helped. But if we're actually working together and you are going to tell me what I need to do, and the way you'll tell me is, number one, if I've got it wrong, you'll tell me I got it wrong. And then if you think about something different that needs to be tried and I listen to that, then we really do have a communication and a medical partnership. And it's up to me to do just crack that door open a little bit. If I can get that door open just a little bit, then that's going to help you with me. And then what else is going to help you with me is if I actually do listen to you. And so that's where that's a big crossroads right there.
There's a leap of faith and a trust that needs to happen, and it's very hard to confer when you're in the middle of it all. But that leap of faith is about patience, and that with time and with love and support, you'll get there. Yeah.
So we are running out of time. I can't imagine this went by 30 minutes, but we're zooming down the road, and I started by talking about fasten your seatbelts, but, you know, it's a short trip. But it's been a very interesting trip. I mean, just to crack some of these doors open that you've cracked open are just extremely interesting. Let's close a little bit here, which I kind of, not kind of, I actually do hate to close. I'd like to continue to talk to you. And we're going to definitely have you back if you're willing to come back, because we're going to talk some more. But the bottom line is, let's take it for the listeners who need a little bit of a programmed approach. What would you say from your perspective about what we might do as participants in discussing the issues? What could we do to edify, construct, evolve the dialogue that needs to take place in mental health? What can we do about it? What should be done about it?
Ooh, what should be done about mental health is a big question, but I think stigma is where it's tricky around the world. I got to try both, but with cancer, everybody rallies around you. They give you maybe a yellow bracelet, and they say fight, and you get all sorts of support and help because people can understand it. They can rally behind you because they can see the enemy and they can understand it. With mental illness, it's not like that. It's very hard to understand, and there's this thing about not doing your best that keeps creeping in. And if we could all work on the stigma, I think people would seek help a lot sooner, and they would be much more willing to keep going back for more help. So the stigma is something that's up to all of us to eradicate, basically, and that will take some time, but it's starting to really change. I think there's a sea change. There's a big shift in understanding just in the last few years even, that was pioneered by people who've been talking about it for a long time. And yeah, stigma, we just need to fight that and get people in with their doctors as partners.
Well, I think the partnership comes from the fact we're there. I was at the American Psychiatric Association meeting in Toronto here in last October, I think it was, and I was very pleased because I'm kind of a non-traditional psychiatrist in one respect, in spite of the fact that I'm a traditional guy, and I was listening to some of the really interesting presentations. And what's going on with psychiatry in general is it's taking a more biologic direction, just like with testicular cancer. I mean, if a person has a biologic imbalance that's measurable, then the whole thing changes dramatically. And the fact that a kid who's, you know, 12 years old in the sixth grade can identify that somebody's got a bipolar illness shows the problem with it, because just a mood swing doesn't make the day anywhere. The deal is, what is the complexity of that human being, and how are we effectively articulating it to each other, to patient, to doctor, to anyone else? How do we actually articulate it better from a more biologic perspective? Because this is what the evolution's all about, in my opinion. And I think it, and a guy like you comes in and says, look, I've fought it through, this is my experience, and some things have helped me. You spell it out quite clearly in your book what really did help you out. I mean, some of it's relationships, some of it's your really, I shouldn't say some of it, I mean, there are pieces to it. You know, your wife, your family, the kids. Those kids sound like very interesting kids, I'll tell you. You've got, you know, the way that all transpired. I'll let the listeners get the book and read about it. But so good. Well, we'll wind it up. How can people get a hold of you? Do you have a website, or what's actually going on in that regard right now?
I do have a website. It's kevinahall.com. So A for my middle initial, kevinahall.com. And I got to admit, I just sort of let my freak flag fly a little there on the landing page. It's not corporate. It's not sexy. It's my art. And behind that, you can find a little bit about my book or send me a message, and I'd love to hear from you. The website needs to be built. It's not quite where it needs to be yet, but it's a work in progress, like I am, I guess.
Well, as we all are, and I am too, with you, okay? And I appreciate your helping me on my path, because this is a very significant positive contribution. And I look forward to talking to you again sometime down the future.
Thanks very much. So do I.
Thank you, Kev. Well, listen, we're going to wind up, guys, and we'll see you again sometime, Kev. Right now, folks, if you want to get a hold of Kevin, you want to leave a connectivity with him. I forgot to mention this. I got so carried away. We're going to have something with Kevin. He and I weren't quite sure about it, but I think we're going to have a book for you. And that's going to be at corebrainjournal.com/015download. Now, when you do the download and you drop your email there, we're going to have a drawing, and Black Sails and White Rabbits is going to be available for you. We're going to have a drawing on that for the people who leave their names there. Sorry I didn't mention that earlier, Kevin. So thank you very much, listeners. Thank you, Kevin, for taking the time over there in New Zealand, and we look forward to talking to you again in the near future.
Thanks very much. It was thrilling to be here.
Thanks for listening to Core Brain Journal. We're working every day behind the scenes to bring you reports that connect research benches with those street trenches. Here we share the complexity of mind science because, as you know, details really do matter. One of the most pervasive, misunderstood challenges is how commonplace medications, like those written for ADHD, are used so regularly without clear guidelines. If you think you'd like more specifics, take a minute to download my 2-page PDF packed with video links and references on the absolute essentials of how to start ADHD medications. They're easily available at corebrainjournal.com/start. Thanks for listening. Do connect and stay tuned. Together we can make a difference.